You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 57 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we have a very strange special edition of the Peltoncast.
We do.
A special edition which I never expected to have.
The special edition which I never expected to have. It's the Kansas City edition of the Peltoncast after I traveled there last weekend.
It's the KCPC.
And to celebrate that, I went and picked up some of a local Kansas City craft brewery, Boulevard Brewing Company beers at the local Total Wine. I'm actually going to drink more Boulevard Brewing Company beers here than I did in Kansas City.
Wait, so why are we drinking? I thought you had drank this in Kansas City.
No, I did have one.
Give it your seal of approval.
I did have one. Yes, I had the 80-acre hoppy wheat I had there.
Okay, and, so we have a lot.
People were drinking it. Like, it was the thing to drink in Kansas City.
Okay, so this is like the Fremont Brewing of Kansas City?
That was about the comparison I was going to go with, yeah.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Okay, so we have a lot of different Boulevard Brewing Company beers
we
here.
Do.
What do we have?
We have the Unfiltered Wheat.
Okay.
That is not very highly rated on Beer Advocate.
Okay.
That is only a 79.
Okay.
The Single Wide IPA.
I would say, let me just throw this out there. Wheat doesn't do well in the fancy beer community.
It doesn't. I was figuring that we needed to adjust for that a little bit. The Single Wide IPA, which is an 85, and then one of their highest rating beers, which is the Calling Double IPA, a 91.
Okay.
There was a couple more I was more excited about that I did not drink when I was in Kansas City. There was a Session IPA they had, Frequent Flyer, that looked pretty good, and then a Tropical Pale Ale. But sadly, the distribution to Seattle is not as widespread as you might hope.
I can't believe that this is in Seattle.
They actually had a stunning number of Boulevard beers at Total Wine, but they were almost all sour ales or like imperial like stouts, like either very heavy or very sour.
We could have been drinking sour beers here.
I mean, I should have gotten one just for you.
Oh,
but
man,
I didn't. So we're gonna go with these three. I assume we should start with the wheat since it's the lightest.
Okay,
like, you don't want to start with the double IPA and go from there. Everything else is going to just tastes like nothing.
You know my feelings. This is a little bit unrelated, but you know my feelings about Session IPAs.
You don't like them.
It's an oxymoron.
Yeah.
There's no such thing.
I happen to like Session IPAs, so I disagree with you.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to be cracking open this Boulevard Wheat here.
Yeah, and I'll begin telling you a little bit about my trip to Kansas City.
Okay. We did for Beer Advocate inflation or deflation for wheat beers. This is actually an 85.
Oh, okay. That sounds about right. So I went on Friday night, was traveling with my friends Kelly and Diana to go surprise our friend Al for her 30th birthday, as well as her wife Gentry.
She didn't know?
That we were going?
Yeah.
Well, Gentry knew because we had to make plans with someone. It would be weird if no one knew.
I was going to say, that's like a long way to go for a poppin'.
Yeah, no, but Al, whose birthday it was, did not know until we walked up and she saw us from them picking us up.
Wow, and she had to put down her barbecue for a second and come and greet you?
Yes. Everyone in Kansas City has
this is everything that I know about Kansas City.
So our friend Gentry was a coworker of ours at the Sonics in Storm, who is from Kansas, went to the University of Kansas, is probably a bigger Kansas fan than we are Husky fans, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it was exciting to go and kind of see her hometown. And so Friday night, first off, we on the way back from the airport, you know, we're hungry, needed to eat something. Went to Steak and Shake.
Oh, really?
And had a more authentic Steak and Shake
experience. Midwest Steak and Shake. Tell me about how that was.
I like that you said, oh, really, as if I had not texted you to tell you that we went there.
that's what this is about.
You're playing it.
Cheers to Kansas City, to Tyreek Hill.
I don't know if we can cheers to Tyreek Hill. I don't
think
that's appropriate.
Come on. He helped me win a fantasy football championship.
Yes. But there is the history of domestic violence.
All right. Well,
which outweighs that.
Cheers to the Royals.
Yeah, okay. Cheers to that. I watched a surprising amount of Royals baseball in bars in Kansas City over the course of the weekend. Anyways, I got to tell you, the authentic Steak and Shake, inevitably, first off, the selection of hamburger and fry meals for $3.99, extensive.
Wow, $3.99?
Yeah.
I mean, this is Kansas City, so that's still like $6 in Seattle, but...
I don't think things were necessarily that much cheaper in Kansas City, but yes. And a much better burger, I would say.
Really?
Than the one I had in Seattle.
You think the burger was much better?
It's at least noticeably better, I would say.
Noticeably better?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
So, all in all, I think the authentic Steak and Shake, a much better experience than going to the Seattle Steak and Shake, which is not surprising to anyone.
I mean, I called everybody who told me that it was worse. I called them all liars. But you're telling me that they're not liars?
I like this. This is good.
It's really not that bad.
Yeah. I know that wheat is not your favorite beer either, but that's good.
It's a little bit tart. I kind of like it.
Yeah. So Saturday, the very first stop on our barbecue tour.
Yes.
What was formerly?
I wasn't sure. I honestly, I've heard nothing about your trip to Kansas City except for the Steak and Shake appearance.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that you necessarily had barbecue.
I mean, that was basically the whole reason I went.
Okay. That's all I want to hear about. I went.
So the first stop was Oklahoma Joe's, which is now, that was the original name of it. It's a complicated story. It's now known as Joe's Kansas City, but people still call it Oklahoma Joe's.
Okay.
My comparison was like, it was like people calling Heck Ed Alaska Airlines Arena.
Okay.
Although then I said this to some of Gentry's family and they were upset that I called it Oklahoma Joe's because they want it to be associated with Kansas City. So it's very confusing.
Huh.
Either no one calls it by that or everyone calls it by that.
Okay.
But anyways,
you've already angered the family of the person you visited.
I know. So after I mentioned on various podcasts I was going to Kansas City, two different
How many other podcasts are you on?
The True Hoop podcast. It also came up there. Two different people, including our loyal listener Noah, reached out to me to say that I had to have the Z-Man sandwich at Joe's Kansas City.
Okay.
Which obviously I did. I split that and then a pulled pork sandwich with Gentry. And it was the best barbecue sandwich I would say I've ever had.
Really?
Yeah. Like a couple of different, like the beef brisket and then onion rings, which added a nice flavor, and
onion
then provolone
rings.
Cheese, which you don't normally see on barbecue sandwiches.
Now, so tell me about, before we even get any further into Kansas City barbecue, what type of barbecue do they have in Kansas City?
So I've read up on this.
Okay.
And it's apparently more molasses based.
Okay.
Which makes it thicker and a bit sweeter.
Okay.
Then obviously a lot of Central Texas barbecue is not even that sauce based. And then Carolina barbecue.
Okay. So they are into barbecue sauce.
Yes.
Okay.
Which
they're
is good.
Very much so.
You know who's into barbecue sauce? This guy.
Okay. Because you go to Texas and you're like, where's the barbecue sauce? You can't even find it.
Yes.
They're like, we have pickles.
So the other specialty of Kansas City barbecue sauce is what's known as burnt ends, which is the end of the brisket, I guess.
Okay.
And it's like fattier and has to be cooked for longer. And so at this Joe's, they only serve burnt ends at the original location, which is located in a convenience store, basically.
Really?
There's actually a functioning gas station outside where we filled up before the meal. And they only serve it on the weekends, I think. And they only serve it until they run out. So you have to get there early.
We waited. How many people possibly get these?
Oh, a lot, especially on Memorial Day weekend. We waited in line for an hour.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which I had to comment on. Like, it's not just people waiting in line for Portland brunch.
I was going to say,
people
you need to come up with a burnt end sneak.
No, I mean, they do have a takeout, but we had to get the authentic experience of waiting in line and eating indoors. And fortunately, we got inside just before the thunderstorm rolled through and started pouring rain.
Oh, man. That really is the real Kansas City experience.
And then cleared out by the time we got out of there.
It's just like that game the Seahawks played against the Chiefs.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, so you waited in line. The sneak would have been that you could have called ahead, gotten it takeout, and then gone and enjoyed some delicious Boulevard Brewing Company beer along with it?
Yeah, I mean, if you could find an appropriate, you know, place that's only a beer bar that does not serve food.
Hopefully we save somebody's life in Kansas City with that idea.
Yeah. I don't think it's that creative. But so the burnt ends, outstanding. I never knew it, but it turns out I love burnt ends.
Really?
And I did some quick Google searching tonight on whether you can find them in Seattle. And it turns out that the location that apparently has them most prominently is a place called Drunkies Two Eye Barbecue.
Drunkies Two Shoe Barbecue?
Two Shoe, yes. Which just recently opened in White Center.
They have
previously
burnt
ends. Had a Freelard location. So we're going to have to make a visit there.
I had no idea.
Yeah, me neither.
Billy O'Neill's an investor.
That's right.
We've talked about this a lot.
We have talked about this.
Well, I'm excited about this.
One of my number one things is going to a place, eating their local food, and then coming back to Seattle and trying to figure out
finding where I worse versions of it.
Yes, that's pretty much it.
Can you describe burnt ends to me a little bit more? Is there
like
bone?
Small cubes? No, there's no. There's small cubes. There's no bone, and they're very flavorful and juicy. So
that's the best part of the brisket.
Exactly. That's like they've stripped away all the worst parts and given you just the best.
It's basically like just eating fat.
Exactly. It's great. Also, I gained several pounds on this trip.
Did you actually?
No.
Okay. We should really. I want to eat that right now.
I know.
What do we do? We should stop recording and go to Drunkies right this second.
I'm not sure that they're still open at this hour. In fact, it seems unlikely that they are.
Okay, so what was stop two on your barbecue trip?
Well, okay, so after that, we went out to Lawrence, home of the University of Kansas, about a 45-minute drive away. And
you drove to Lawrence, Kansas?
Yep.
Just to see the campus, or?
Saw the campus, took a tour of that. We went to, they have a sort of small museum. We went to the Kansas Athletics Hall of Fame, and then this small museum that they've created around the original rules of basketball that... There was a 30 for 30 about this that a Kansas alum purchased for $3.8 million and either donated or allowed to be displayed right off of the fog
on
Fieldhouse there, the home of Kansas basketball.
So these are the original rules like written for the Peach Basket?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. And it's weird because there's just two pages of rules, but they have all this other stuff kind of built around it, but it's still kind of cool.
How many photos of Nick Collison did you see?
There was the display of him is part of the KU Athletics Hall of Fame, and then he was pictured at one point when there's like a room where you can watch videos, and I was waiting for him. It took a while, but finally they got to Nick Collison.
Okay, thank God.
Yeah, definitely more excited about seeing him than, you know, Paul Pierce, Wilt Chamberlain, whatever.
Never heard
I'm here for Nick Collison. So after that, we explored the town, went to downtown at Lawrence. As it is. Basically their version of the Ave. Went to another brewery, Free State Brewing.
Okay.
Which is much smaller, but was pretty good. And one of their signature beers, the Yakamaniac IPA, named after the Yakima hops that they use. So,
okay. What is the Zeebo sandwich named after? It's not actually called the Zeebo sandwich.
It's not named after Zachary Adam. Z-Man.
Z-Man. Who's Z-Man?
It was a customer, apparently, who suggested this idea.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, shouts to Z-Man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good thinking, Z-Man. Then we went to Free State Brewing, and then we went to this kind of college bar named the Sand Bar, which I'd heard about for many years.
Okay.
Got to experience that.
You'd heard about from who?
From Gentry and other people who went to Kansas.
Okay.
Yeah.
This seems like a very strange detour that you took on your trip to Kansas City.
Yeah.
You're going to some college bars in Lawrence, Kansas. Did you have any barbecue there?
No.
Okay.
We came back to the Kansas City suburbs where they live for dinner and went to this place called Unforked that I feel like could very easily just come into Seattle and operate. It's kind of like a trendy restaurant.
Was it barbecue?
It wasn't really barbecue. No, I had tacos there.
Okay.
So no barbecue on that one. And then the next morning for lunch, we went to this place called Top Golf, which is apparently a thing around the country, including in Hillsboro in the Portland suburbs.
Huh.
It's basically like a driving range, except they've created this electronic scoring system that you score points based on how far how close you get to various holes of different distances throughout the driving range.
Okay.
So I had not swung a golf club in conservatively at least 18 years. So that was an interesting experience. Wasn't as bad as I expected. I actually started off really well. I nearly won the first game we played and then choked at the end because golf is a terrible sport for me because it's all mental. But we ate there. And then so the final stop and the highlight from a culinary standpoint of the tour went to a place called Char Bar, which is kind of like very trendy hip barbecue restaurant that also had an extensive beer list, as I was texting you about that they had let's see, I ended up going with the Goose Island Sophie on tap,
okay,
which is one of my favorites.
And they, you said they had three Floyds on tap?
They did.
And you didn't have any
Well, I thought I was going to have a second beer, but then I ended up, like, didn't have time to do it before we left. So that was a real loss.
That was a huge mistake.
It was a huge mistake. I regret the error.
Because what you have to do, you have to consider the alternative cost.
No, I agree.
Of every beer that you drink. And you can get Goose Island Sophie here anytime you want.
I mean, I was noting that I could have it on tap, which is a better experience.
Come on. It's not that big of a difference.
I know.
It's the difference between having something on tap versus in the bottle or at all.
Look, if I had it to do over again.
Okay.
I would definitely, I regret the error of my decision there.
Okay. So what did you eat at this place?
So I had their fried chicken dinner, which was a Sunday-only special.
Oh, nice.
Anytime you've got a Sunday-only fried chicken special, I feel pretty good about ordering that.
If there's a special that only happens on one day of the week, you probably want to get that.
So I would say their fried chicken, I mean, it's not obviously up to screen door standards, because nothing is, but better than Mo'ono's fried chicken.
Okay.
So this was really good fried chicken. And then tried a little bit of everything else at the table. They had excellent ribs.
Are those the only ribs that you had your whole time in Kansas City? Man.
I think so. Mac and cheese with burnt ends.
Oh.
That was a good option.
How did you not order that?
I mean, okay. I ate some of it.
Okay.
Like I was trying a little bit of everything.
You might have died had you gotten the mac and cheese with burnt ends.
No, actually, it wasn't that large. It probably would have been better for me than the fried chicken dinner as it turned out.
Yeah, it's something where if it only happens once a week and has the word dinner at the end, you're going to want to order that. I think you made the right call here.
Thank you. Despite my errant beer choice. So
that was the biggest mistake that you made.
Oh, without question. So that was pretty much it for the trip. We were only there for basically two full days. Flew out Monday morning. So I definitely feel like I need to go back to explore more of the Kansas City barbecue scene.
Okay. And are there any, did we discuss this? You had your goal of going to every single burrito place from the burrito bracket.
They do not have any in Kansas.
There's no barbecue burritos.
No. I mean, there.
I would eat that.
I mean, the Pecos burrito is a pretty good choice.
Yeah, that's great.
Have you had that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would definitely eat that in Kansas City.
There were some locations. I went and reviewed this today because I was looking up the locations in Denver since we were making plans to go to the UW-Colorado game this fall.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you're going to go to Denver?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Well, you're going to be going to Boulder, but...
Well, you'll fly into Denver. There are two burrito locations in Denver, so...
Interesting.
I very much look forward to trying those out.
So while you were in Kansas City eating barbecue, here in Seattle, every single person in the city was at Loretta's.
That is a true story, including nearly every listener of this podcast, nearly all one of you.
All of the listener went to Loretta's.
I feel a little bit offended that it took them being named the fourth best burger in America for people to go to Loretta's who listen to this podcast, given that we've been touting it for a long time here.
That is true. If you haven't, you should go back and listen to our podcast with Kevin Alexander talking about the best burgers in Seattle, breaking them down. It was an excellent podcast. And this week...
Well, wait, I wanted to stay on the Loretta scene.
Okay. You pulled out your phone. I didn't know what I was supposed to do there.
Well, I thought
there might have been some urgent NBA news. It's like I'm going to have to talk for a long time.
No. I previewed this a little bit earlier today. So,
So every single person in Seattle was at Loretta's. It sounded like they were packed. They're running out of food at Loretta's.
Yeah,
right?
we'll go through this. So my friend Ross texts me on Friday afternoon and says, "Did I leave work today and drive straight to Loretta's while listening to the Pelton cast?" Yes, I did. I feel sort of bad for them. They're going to become a thing after that story. The bartender just said, "It's like the locusts have descended on us." I kid you not. Other bartenders said they've been getting calls asking about reservations.
I love that idea. Reservations at Loretta's.
I know. It's like you do not. You clearly did not read the actual article. You do not understand what you're getting into. And then he follows this up with, here's his conclusion. Have to say the second Loretta's burger, one beer in, was among the best burgers I've ever had.
There you go. So, I'm happy that he made the decision to have to get two burgers.
You're definitely going to want to do that. So... I don't know if our loyal listener, Nate, was able to do that because he went there and was told they ran out of food. That's how busy they were. But then he followed up in a much happier tweet that they found some food and has a picture of the former site of a Loretta's Tavern.
I don't think I can think of a restaurant that is would be less happy about this than Loretta's.
No, yeah.
Like, this is not what they wanted at all. But unfortunately, they make an amazing burger. I mean, the thing that's worst about it is people who've moved to South Park basically just to go to Loretta's, which is a thing that has happened to people I know. And now all of a sudden, everybody's going to be at Loretta's. It's not a neighborhood bar anymore. It's a destination bar.
Well, you've said that you think that South Park is going to get even more expensive strictly because of this burger ranking.
Did I say that?
I think that you implied that, didn't you?
I got to get in right now.
Yes. Now is the time.
We're going to have to put in our reservations now. Who knows when the next time we'll be able to go to Loretta's is.
This is so hard to believe. Like, I keep telling people this story. Like, it's this bar literally down the street from me. I was there on Monday, and then on Wednesday, it was one of the four best burgers in the country.
I was saying this earlier, is I've seen the Tavern Burger be ranked very high. I think there's a Seattle Met list of the top burgers in Seattle from a few years ago, and they have it as the number one burger in Seattle. It's not like this is the first publication to have noticed this, but I don't understand exactly why people have. Maybe it's because it's number four nationally.
Yeah,
and it's not just. It feels like, and also the Kevin Alexander's burger credentials are impressive.
Yes, they are.
So maybe it's that he went to 330 burger places and determined out of all of those burger places that this is the number four one. It's not like Seattle Met going to 20 Seattle burger places.
20. We are currently at number 13, by the way.
Are we?
Yes. I looked that up earlier. And earlier today, we finally made it to the People's Burger because of the fact that I went to the location opposite CenturyLink Field instead of waiting to see whether it might be at Westlake Park.
The People's Burger. Liars about being at Westlake Park. Not that good of a burger.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here's the thing. I really wanted so badly to like this burger. First off, it's a really good-looking burger. Like, if you go to our search for Seattle's Best Burger page and check out the photo we have posted there, don't do it if it's early Wednesday morning because I won't have posted it yet by that point. It's a phenomenal looking burger.
It smells good too.
Yeah. And then you eat it and it's just not there.
It's just a burger.
Well, I mean, I think first off, I had a lot of special sauce. You did not.
Basically none. I don't know if I saw a drip of special sauce.
It wasn't that good.
The sauce wasn't that good?
Yeah, which I don't know how you, like, that's usually the best part of a burger.
Okay, can I break this down for you?
Okay, break it down.
I think the bun was pretty solid.
Yeah.
Then you've got some old kind of crumpled looking arugula, I think.
I was fine with the arugula.
A tomato, which was both mealy and crunchy somehow at the same time. I can tell you that it was not a tour de force of a tomato.
Exactly. I did not eat the tomato because even though I did not get this in last week, like Kevin Alexander, I do not like tomatoes on burgers.
You know, Kevin Alexander has kind of sold me on being against tomatoes, not because tomatoes are bad, but because it's so hard to find a good tomato on a burger. So I'm a little bit sold on that. Anyway, the tomato, not a tour de force at all. There was some American cheese, which was totally fine. I thought the burger itself tasted okay.
I thought it was, like, too well done.
But it was a little bit dry.
Very dry.
And it just wasn't, it was almost nothing to me. The burger, it was a dry burger. I thought the fries were pretty good. But in general, I think it may have been the worst burger that we've had yet.
Interesting. I didn't go quite that far. But it's definitely in the bottom three of the burgers we've had thus far.
It was another burger where it's not like the quality felt that high of anything on the burger. Nothing really stood out. I mean, the meat probably more so than anything else because it wasn't bad meat, but it also, it's not like it was like rich, juicy meat.
No.
So, what did you give this burger?
I gave it an 83.
Gave it an 80. It just didn't really do it for me.
All right. Well, do you have a plan for what we're going to do next week?
No, do you?
Not really. I mean, we're going to have to probably do it on Tuesday again because I'm going to be gone this weekend for the NBA Finals.
Should we do Lunchbox Laboratory?
I think so. I mean, I was studying the menu there intently because there was a consideration that we might go there today. I think it's time to do that.
All right. It's time.
Yeah.
It's Lunchbox Laboratory time. Did you want to talk NBA Finals? Because you recently just went to Kansas City, and then this coming weekend, you're going to San Francisco / Oakland.
In terms of previewing the trip?
Yeah. Well, and also maybe the NBA Finals.
I mean, I'm going to talk enough about them. If you want to hear that, listen to the NBA Lockdown podcast, where we actually talk about basketball in a basketball podcast. As far as the trip, I'm very excited. It'll be now three times in, well, I guess, I mean, I went three different times during last year's finals to the Bay, and then once in the fall, and then now this. So I've got some spots at this point. Excited to get back to the Mission District and have some more of the top burritos in the burrito bracket power rankings. La Taqueria being number one on my personal list.
Have we talked on this podcast about your, what is it, Sichuan food?
Burmese food, yes.
Burmese.
The visit I had in the fall was after we were doing the podcast.
Okay.
So yeah, so we've talked about Burma Superstar, which is maybe my favorite. So the one thing to go back to my last meal in Kansas City, I declared it at the table a top five meal of my life.
Wow.
And then I had to like determine what else was in that list.
I mean, yeah, you can't just be declaring things top five.
And definitely the first time I went to, I mean, it's hard to like separate, like, you know, there's a lot of places in Seattle I love, but were any individual one of those ones one of the top five meals of my life? Odds are probably not. But the first time I went to Burma Superstar, probably in there. In fact, almost certainly in there.
And are you going back?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just a matter of when.
Okay.
I'm also excited to try out Shandong, which is the favorite of our I keep calling it True Hoop, don't I? It's the basketball analogy now. Our TBA producer, Jade Hoy. So maybe we'll check that out after the live TBA show in Oakland on Saturday night.
Are you meeting up with Nate Duncan? He's in the area, right?
Yes. Yeah, okay. We'll go to Burma Superstar together. He's the one who's introduced me to it. And then we'll discuss In and Out there.
And then you'll discuss In and Out there?
Yeah.
At Burma Superstar?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to hearing about that also.
We'll see whether anything on the Burma Superstar menu qualifies as a tour de force. I think it's time, though. We need to get back to our usual covefe of Seattle sports.
Okay. Should we start with Sonics Arena news?
We should. So, while we're on the topic of Kansas City, since this is the Kansas City cast, I wanted to talk about the Sprint Center in Kansas City, which is interestingly relevant to the Key Arena renovation, in as much it was a building that was built by AEG, one of the competitors here as part of the Seattle Partners Group, at a time when it was run by Tim Leiwicki, who is now in charge of Oakview Group, the other competitor to renovate Key Arena. And so they built this arena beginning in 2005. And I would like to read to you a little bit from the AP's account of them breaking ground on the Sprint Center in 2005. As soon as this gets pulled up, and I should have probably loaded it ahead of time, but I did not plan ahead that well.
I'm curious about this. I think I have a sense of where it's going. Because I've crunched the numbers about whether Kansas City has a basketball team.
Or an NHL team, for that matter. All right, here. Finally coming up. All right, Dateline Kansas City, Missouri.
Kansas City, Missouri.
Standing on what they hope will one day be the home court or ice of an NBA or NHL team, Kansas City civic and business leaders on Friday broke ground on the $250 million Sprint Center. Blah, 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 blah. The big question is who will call the Sprint Center home when it's completed? While an arena football team is signed on to play in the 18,000 to 20,000 seat arena, officials have yet to ink a deal with a top shelf basketball or hockey team, which, by the way, makes it sound like a form of liquor. We're going to do everything to bring one here, said Tim Leiwicki, president and CEO of Anschutz Entertainment Group of Los Angeles, which is contributing $50 million to the project and will manage the arena. So there you go. That was the quote from 2005. Then we flash ahead to 2012, at which point we'll note that Kansas City did not, again, have an NBA or NHL team. And at that point, he had a slightly contentious interview with the sports anchor of the local NBC
affiliate. This is Tim Leiwicki?
Yeah.
The person who's trying to do the exact same thing right now?
It is. When we first built this, we were dedicated to trying to find an anchor tenant. Now I'm looking at it and going, be careful, because if we bring an anchor tenant here and it doesn't do well, it will kill this building. It will kill the downtown renaissance that has been created here. I still think a team's coming. It is now 2017, 5 years after that interview.
And Tim Leiwicki is very gone.
He's has gone a couple different places after AEG. Again, still no NBA and NHL team.
So wait, what is the argument against having a tenant? That they just want nothing?
The argument is that basically they'd have to give up a lot of the flexibility and the lucrative dates that allows them to book concerts, book other events like this. They also host the Big 12 basketball tournament, an annual preseason college basketball tournament, the CBE Classic. I think another Kansas game that's played there annually. And so all of these in concerts, like the arena is very profitable. And one of the things that LieWiki has cited is that, you know, they repaid their bonds that they took out ahead of time because it's so profitable. And the entertainment district around that, which is known as the Power and Light District, is in fact like a thriving, you know, area in that city that has been revitalized because of some other, you know, reconstruction in the area. We did not in fact go there because I was told it was too bro-y.
Okay.
Which is both a sign of its success and also probably a reason to stay away. But so basically what happened is they were so successful doing these other non-NBA NHL things that it would be difficult for them to bring the NBA and NHL in. Now, it's also true that, A, they did try and bring the Pittsburgh Penguins there. They were close to relocating before getting the deal to stay in Pittsburgh.
Wait, aren't they one of the original six NHL teams?
I don't think they're one of the original six. No.
Okay, but they're a very classic NHL team. Yeah. Let's say the Phoenix Coyotes moving.
Yeah, you know the Sonics moved. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I think the Penguins are different than the Sonics, even. Okay.
I suppose so. They've probably won more championships, I would imagine. More Stanley Cups. So, in fairness, it's also, you know, difficult to find the money to have a local ownership group to bring a team to Kansas City. Like, I'm sure if they actually wanted an NHL team that they could do it, and they just haven't been able to. And that's where I don't think the comparison to Seattle completely holds up. But it is a little worrisome from the standpoint of, you know, if Oakview Group or Seattle Partners with AEG, if they build this arena and find that it is profitable primarily as a concert venue, as you've talked about on past episodes of the Pelton Cast, you know, will that reduce their incentive to work with NHL and NBA ownership groups to bring a team here? I think that is a fair question. And it's interesting, LieWiki was asked about this when the day they submitted their RFP to renovate Key Arena. He was on the Brock and Salk show on ESPN 710. And one of the things he said as part of that was, I think it's destined to have a winter sports franchise, but you have to build it with an understanding we may be Sprint Center. And is that bad?
Yeah.
Yes, it's bad.
I mean, that's, for our purposes, the primary reason that we're concerned with this is getting an arena to rehost an NBA team and potentially a hockey team.
Exactly. I mean, the point he made is, well, you're privatizing the arena and it would still be more profitable than it would be in its current state. But the problem with that argument
is wouldn't be bad if there was also an arena in SoTo.
Right. The problem with that argument is that it's been made very clear that the city council does not plan to approve both a Key Arena renovation and the SoTo Arena. And that's the alternative cost, is if you renovate Key Arena and don't bring an NBA or NHL team there, then you're giving up the opportunity of bringing them to the SoTo Arena, whereas we've talked about in the past, that is their sole goal, is to bring those teams there.
I mean, this is a full-on cautionary tale, right?
Yeah, I think it definitely should be worrisome to the Seattle City Council and to residents.
Okay. I think we know what the future is here. We know what's coming.
Wait, do we?
Yes.
I don't know if we necessarily
Because do. When the City Council looks at this, they're going to be looking at it from a profit and loss margin, and they don't look at Sprint Center as a cautionary tale. Their goal isn't ultimately to bring an NBA team or to bring an NHL team to Seattle.
I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. So there was an interesting interview today. We talked in the past about the Seattle Growth Podcast, which devoted its second season to discussing the potential return of the Sonics. And today, there was kind of a special addendum to that season focusing on, you know, the status of the Key Arena renovation proposals. And Professor Shulman, who runs that podcast, had an interview with Rob Johnson of the Seattle City Council, who, you know, I think did a very good job of speaking to sort of the issues that the council is weighing. Definitely emphasized how much of an issue figuring out what they do with Key Arena if, you know, they do build an arena in SoTo is a factor. Also emphasized how much ahead the SoTo Arena is in the process in terms of having already completed the environmental impact study, the design planning, everything like that. He was a person who voted in favor of the street vacation last year, which would have paved the way for a SoTo Arena. The other surprising thing is he said that, you know, the current memorandum of understanding is still in force, which would have provided public financing for the SoTo Arena. I guess I'm not sure if they can just tear that up unilaterally as part of this discussions, or they have to negotiate a replacement memorandum of understanding first as the council is sort of deliberating on this. And then the other interesting thing he noted was that he thought that the Oakview group was going to drop their request for a public financing for a parking garage. And lo and behold, that is in fact what happened on Monday of this week, where they told the Seattle Times, Jeff Baker, that they are no longer planning that parking garage and will just have 400 spaces of underground parking as part of the new entrance they're planning.
Okay, so what does that mean, them dropping this?
So number one, it reduces the amount of public funding that they're asking for. It's now just in terms of the tax breaks and rebates and things like that.
And they're the only group who are asking for public funds?
No. I mean, they were the only group asking for public funds in that specific, like, a direct subsidy manner. The Seattle Partners Group is still the one that's looking to use the city's bonding capacity to finance the arena, something that Oakview is not doing. The SoTo Group originally was doing, but now in their revised plan is not doing.
Okay. But so it also means there'll be less parking available.
It does, yes. It still seems like I think the council will see this as a net positive because of the fact that, you know, the issue that Johnson brought up in this interview is that he thought that, you know, the Seattle Partners proposal was kind of more aesthetically pleasing, better fit into the architecture of the Seattle Center because it did not have this parking garage. So I think it's probably, and then I think the important takeaway is less about the parking garage and more about the fact that we've seen now, this is a question I posed, I think last week, that Oakview is willing to negotiate off their original proposal. That is not a final proposal.
Yes, and so the understanding is that probably each of them would be willing to negotiate.
I don't know that I think that Seattle Partners is willing to negotiate. I think they've made their offer and they're sticking to it.
Okay.
We'll see though. I mean, that's the other thing that Rob Johnson made clear in this interview is that the city council plans to do the same level of due diligence with this proposal that they did with the Chris Hansen proposal when it was first approved by city council in 2012.
Okay, so what about the storm? Has there been any progress for them?
There has been. The city council, one thing they did specifically do today is approve that new 10-year lease that we talked about on last week's podcast for the storm that will pay them $100,000 a year is part compensation for the possibility of relocation and then provides contingencies for funding if they are forced to relocate. And our little listener, Jimmy, posed a good question today on Twitter asking, where do we think the Storm and Seattle U might play in case there is a renovation and they're forced out of Key Arena? This is completely speculative on my part. I know nothing about this. In Seattle U's case, I think it would be logical for them to play at the Showair Center in Kent.
Really?
If they decided that...
They wouldn't just move back?
They could play in their on-campus Connolly Center. That's significantly smaller, substantially smaller, and not really in line with their vision of, you know, when they moved their programs to D1, what they wanted to do with men's basketball. But they've played, I think, a game or two a year historically in the Showair Center. So I think that's, you know, a kind of a relationship that might make sense for them going forward.
Okay.
With the Storm, I think...
Kind of insane for Seattle U to be playing in Kent, but okay.
It's a little strange. For the Storm, I think the most logical spot for them is probably to play at Hack Ed, because it won't be occupied during the summer.
And I think you mentioned that last week as probably one of their options.
Yeah, I mean, they have not played in Hack Ed ever. When they had their playoff game relocated a few years ago, they went to the Tacoma Dome. And I suppose that's a possibility. Showair could also be a possibility for them. But as I think about where kind of the Storm demographic is of the Storm season ticket holder, I feel like staying within the city is a better idea than going south.
Kent is not a good idea.
It is not really, you know, the heart of Storm fans, I wouldn't say. So I think that covers that.
Okay, well, that's interesting progress. I'm very curious about this Sprint Center story and kind of how that's unfolded there.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if that becomes more of an issue as we go forward and get more serious in this process. According to the timeline that Rob Johnson laid out in his interview, which, you know, conforms more or less to what Ed Murray had said in the past, sounds like next couple of weeks we anticipate hearing a decision.
Okay. So still within the month of June, though, is when Ed Murray was expecting, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
The deadline, quote unquote, is the end of June, but
and there would still be a preference between the two Kirin renovation groups.
Yeah, I mean, this the council will decide between the Key Arena proposals and the Soto proposal.
This is just the Ed Murray recommendation.
Yeah, the mayor has no say in that.
Okay.
Ultimately, other than his advisory capacity. All right, that being said, let's get to, it's that time of week again. Don't burn yourself. We got Mariner's hot takes coming at you.
You think I'm going to go one way? But instead, we're switching it up this week for Mariner's hot takes because the Mariners right now have a window.
A window?
Right now, they come off a 3-game winning streak and have 11 in a row at home.
Is this going to be the start of that 20-plus game winning streak I heard about so much about a couple weeks ago?
They have a small window right now where the Mariners can get back into the season. And if they can win every single one of these series, all of a sudden they're looking at a 500 record and everybody's coming back. Starting this week, James Paxton coming back from injury. Felix rehabbing. Iwakuma still hurt. That's a good thing. Everybody's going to be back at the end of this break. And if they can get toward 500 here, they'll be able to look at the playoffs and say, there's a chance.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Right now, they sit at about 10% in playoff odds. They could be up to 15 at the end of this streak.
Oh, 15.
This is so many games. This is like the Spurs rodeo road trip in reverse.
There you go.
So if they can make it, winning every single one of these series, they'll be sitting right at 500. They have to rest on the bats, but they'll have Cy Young winner James Paxton back. He is starting on Wednesday.
So you think he's going to win it despite the time he's missed here?
No doubt about it. He's got it locked up.
That is a hot take.
Cy Young's locked up. Are you kidding me? Maybe John Segura is back and hitting better than ever. Cano is hitting well. Kyle Seager working his way out of that slump to start the season. Because as you know, if there's one thing about baseball players to know, is that no matter what happens at any period, they will always end up hitting what they have hit in the previous season.
Yeah, that's pretty much true.
So Kyle Seager's working his way out of it all of a sudden.
Wait, is Kyle Seager making regression to the mean work for them?
The Mariners are making regression to the mean work for them. I don't think Mike Zunino can hit under 200 for the season.
Challenge accepted.
This is almost not even a hot take. This is like kind of a lukewarm take.
It is. It is.
It's not quite hot enough. I just really think that the Mariners have a window here.
I mean, they do. I mean, things looked pretty hopeless after the 5-game losing streak last week.
It took this combination of winning 3 in a row, including going into Colorado and winning 2 and stealing one from the Red Sox, who are very hot. But being able to win those 3 to set themselves up for a chance to be able to make a difference. Let's say that they'd lost those 3, season's over. It's done. This is it right here, though. This is the season.
They got to do it now.
If they don't do it in these next 11 games, if they come out of the next 11 games under 500 or at 500 for those games, season is mostly over. I mean, there's so many teams that they have to climb because the division's gone. The Astros have won the division.
Congrats to them.
But there's so many teams that they have to climb for the wild card. They're only 4.5 games back, but they have to climb over 6-7 teams to get there, which is not an easy task.
Uh-huh. You got anything else on the Mariners here?
That's it, my lukewarm take.
Okay. Well, speaking of teams with extended homestands, the Seattle Storm has played their last four games at home. You know, I don't know. I think I've lost the math. Yeah, their last four games. Their last four games at home.
Yeah, I know you're not great at math.
It's not a strong suit. And they've won all of them to go now. They run the record now to 4-1 after their season opening loss in Los Angeles without Sue Bird and Brianna Stewart. Over the weekend, they beat New York 87-81 on Friday in a game where UW's own Sammy Whitcomb scored 22 points in 15 minutes.
Really?
All of them in the second half.
Wow, she's like Kelly Olynyk.
Yes. Coming off the bench to shoot 6 of 8 from three-point range as the Storm made a franchise record 14 threes as a team. She followed that up with 9 points on Sunday as the Storm shot 61.4% from the field and beat Indiana 94-70. They have moved all the way up to number 2 in the AP's WNBA power rankings.
Really?
And the number 1 team, the Minnesota Lynx, coming to town on Saturday in a showdown.
A WNBA showdown.
Yeah. This will be, you know, kind of the biggest Storm game in a while, I would say.
Where who is the star player in the Lynx?
Maya Moore.
Okay.
Former WNBA MVP Maya Moore.
How is Kelsey Plum doing now that she's had a chance to play?
Oh, not well at all.
Oh, no.
She's played 2 games.
Why has she only played 2 games?
Well, she was because of the injuries.
I didn't even know she was injured.
Yeah, we talked about it at some point. Her debut came last week.
And yeah, I don't listen when you talk. That's been well established.
That has been well established. Her debut, she had like 3 turnovers basically in the first 2 or 3 minutes she played. Really struggled with the pressure a little bit that Dallas was putting on her. And then kind of got a little more comfortable as the game went on, but then her second game was not much better. So now through 2 games, she has 7 turnovers and 5 points.
Oh, no.
So, you know, it's early.
It's very early. It's 2 games.
It's too early.
It's basically nothing, but still. Okay.
Well, not off to a great start.
I hope things turn around there a little bit.
Yeah.
What about the Sounders as we move through a roundup?
So the Sounders got another win at home last weekend on Saturday, beating the hated rival Portland Timbers 1-0 in a game where the Timbers probably had the upper hand after Christian Roldan scored in the 4th minute in what was all the Sounders needed. But, you know, Portland had a dramatic advantage in terms of shots on goal, had more expected goals by 538's calculation, both in terms of their shots and then the rest of the play. So, you know, the Sounders have had a lot of games where they've outplayed their opponents and lost. It was about time that they finally got one the other way.
Yes.
So this week, a 2-match week for the Sounders, who on Wednesday will play at Columbus and then return home on Sunday to host the Houston Dynamo. And this is going to be trouble. Because Bruce Arena has called up to the U.S. national team in advance of World Cup qualifiers next weekend. He's called up both Clint Dempsey and Jordan Morris.
Okay.
The Sounders have one other experienced forward on their roster. That's Will Bruin, who you'll recall dislocated his elbow a couple weeks ago and remains sidelined. So that means the only forward who is healthy and available on the roster is Shea Adekoya, a rookie homegrown prospect who has basically not played in the MLS ever.
Okay. What about Harry Shipp?
You know, I mean, he'll be in the mix as part of that attacking group, but he's not really a traditional forward. You know, neither is Lodero, obviously, or Alvaro Fernandez. Really, you know.
Are we going to see forward Jovan Jones again?
Oh, that's actually a legitimate possibility. He may have the most attacking talent in terms of forward on the team.
I mean, he was their forward for months last year.
Yeah, that's actually, surprisingly, I didn't see that get referenced, but that may very well happen. The one small bit of good news is that Aaron Kovar, who has not yet played this season following groin surgery, was on the 18-man active roster on Saturday and could be in the mix for these 2 games.
Okay.
Gives him a little more attacking talent. And it's a bummer because Columbus has kind of struggled. They have the 3rd worst defense in MLS, according to 538 Soccer Power Index, the 5th lowest rating overall. This was a chance for you to get a point on the road.
So are they going to be gone for both matches?
Yes.
Oh, my. It had to come on a week when they played 2 games?
Yes.
Oh, man.
So in the second game, Houston will be without DeMarcus Beasley, who also was called up to the USMNT, their star defender. But they have a number of players who were called up to the Honduran national team, and they're not going to leave until after the Sounders match. So Houston, which you'll recall beat the Sounders in the season opener, 3rd in the West so far in points per game and 5th in the MLS in expected goal differential. So they're playing pretty well.
This is going to be a long week.
It does look like that.
So the goal would be to get out of this week with 2 points.
Yeah, I think that's a very reasonable goal.
Basically, try not to lose a game. And they're coming
off. 0-0 draw would be terrific.
They could score goals in the draw if they'd like, but they're coming off two consecutive wins. So been able to catch up a little bit and then just try to get out of these two matches with points.
Yep. And then they will be off the next weekend for the international break. So then after that, Dempsey and Morris, actually, I guess they're probably going to then miss the U.S. Open Cup the following week. So it'll be a while.
But it shows how important that point that they, those 3 points that they picked up against Portland are, considering, despite the fact that they didn't necessarily play that well, but considering that they're going to be without Jordan Morris and Clint Dempsey for this week.
Yep.
So that was huge, picking up those 3 points.
Yep. All right. Well, now that we've cracked open this the Calling Double IPA, I think a toast is in order.
Yes.
To UW Women's Athletics, a huge day on Sunday. Started off with UW Women's Crew winning the fourth national championship in program history and the first since 2001. And moreover, becoming the first program in the 21-year history of the NCAA Rowing Championships to sweep all three grand finals.
Yeah, they're like the Warriors. Okay.
They won the Varsity 8. They won the second Varsity 8.
Oh, there
you
go.
And they won the Varsity 4 under first-year head coach Yasmin Farouk. So congrats to the Huskies.
We've been cheering for them since the beginning. And I've said it on this podcast a lot. UW is a women's crew school now.
Absolutely.
I had to look verify what the sport was.
Later on Sunday at Husky Softball Stadium, the UW softball team beat Utah 2-1 in the deciding game 3 of the Super Regionals to get a 2-1 victory over the Utes and advanced to the Women's College World Series for the first time since 2013.
All right. One more toast.
Yeah.
There we go.
Absolutely in order. So the Huskies will begin play in the Women's College World Series Thursday against number 3 seed Oregon.
Oh, man.
At 4 p.m. They actually won 2 of 3 at Oregon during the Pac-12 season. Jeff Sagarin does softball ratings and has UW 4th in the country and 3rd among the teams in the Women's College World Series because number 2 seed Arizona got upset in a bit of a shocking upset.
Man, I'm still so shocked. Regional. Pac-12 really dominates and
very good at softball. We are so good at softball.
Okay, so they have the 3rd best chance of winning the tournament?
Well, they have the 3rd best rating, but here's the bad news.
Oh, no.
You know who has the best rating of anyone in Omaha?
Oregon.
It is, in fact, Oregon. So, you know, I think it's basically like whoever wins that game is going to get to the final because the other side of the bracket is the 15 seed that beat Arizona and then a 10 seed.
Oh, they got upset by a 15 seed?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's like the seeding of the individual region.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I whoever comes out of that is going to have a huge advantage in terms of getting to the final to likely face the top-seeded Florida Gators.
Are these 3-game series, all of them?
Well, it's double elimination. So what happens if you lose the first game, you go into the loser bracket. And so the Huskies, you know, will face either the winner or the loser of Oklahoma and Baylor, Baylor being the team that knocked off Arizona. And if you do win your way out of the loser's bracket by winning 2 games there against both of the losers in the other games, then you face the winner of those first 2 games and have to beat them twice. That's how it works.
Okay.
It's a bit complex.
I'll let you explain that to me later.
Yeah.
There's going to be a map. You're going to have to draw a lot of pictures.
There's a flowchart. Maybe.
But I look forward to it. When do they play Oregon?
Thursday at 4 p.m.
Okay. And that's game. So it's not game one. They have 1 game against Oregon.
Yes.
Okay. And they don't play them again.
Well, they might face them again if the loser of that game comes out of the loser's bracket. And the winner remains in the winner's bracket. Then they would face him.
So that's a huge game against Oregon.
It is a huge game against Oregon.
How many teams are left overall?
8 teams make the College World Series.
Okay, so they're in the Elite Eight.
Yes.
Oh, man. I'm excited about this. I love when we care about women's softball.
It is one of the most exciting 3 weeks of the year.
I'm so excited to find out what happens. The game times are always terrible, too.
It was actually like,
are you flying to Oakland?
No, I mean, I'll be at Oracle Arena during this game.
Okay.
Like during pregame press.
But I mean, you can pay attention to this. No, you're not going to be in a big game or anything.
Exactly. We'll see how good the Wi-Fi is there.
And that's on ESPN?
I'm not sure if that's on ESPN or ESPN2, but it's the
but
ESPN...
But I can stream it while I'm working?
It's the ESPN family of networks.
All that matters is that I can stream it while I'm working. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any chance to compete against Oregon is great.
And the timing is actually quite convenient being on Central Time. Could go out and eat barbecue and come back and watch the game. So.
And then any news on the Seahawks?
Yeah. Some interesting bits of news. Today was the first day of OTAs, which have been shortened because of the Seahawks getting docked for their illegal contact during OTAs last year. Was evident from the photos on their website that Earl Thomas participated in the practice today. So that's encouraging to see as he continues his comeback.
Yeah, do we know what percent Earl Thomas is at? How much he's really competing? Or
nope.
Okay.
I don't think
it'd be an almost impossible thing to know.
I don't think Pete Carroll has met with the media since then. So, you know, he'll do that at some point during OTAs, and then we'll know a little bit more. Also saw where Tyler Lockett said in an interview that he is on track to be back week one and maybe even participate in training camp. So that's good to see.
Okay.
The other piece of Seahawks news today, after his visit last week, Pat Kirwan of SiriusXM Radio speculated the Seahawks are unlikely to sign Colin Kaepernick.
Who supposedly is a good friend of Pete Carroll's.
Kirwan, not Colin Kaepernick. Yes. I mean, the problem with this report is that it really doesn't tell us anything about why they're unlikely to sign him, if it's because of the fact that Kaepernick, you know, still wants to...
Do you think they need to release why they don't sign any player?
Well, no, I mean, they don't need to specifically release it, but I'm saying reporting that they're unlikely to sign someone doesn't really tell us as much as why, because it's a big difference between the Seahawks don't think Colin Kaepernick could help their football team and, you know, Colin Kaepernick still sees himself as a starter, doesn't really want to be a backup. Colin Kaepernick wants too much money. There's a variety of possible explanations for this that would tell us different things about the Seahawks' level of interest in him.
Okay. I mean, I think what's most important is it doesn't look like they're going to sign him.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a bummer.
All of those things adding up to, they're likely not to sign him. It could be 20% of all those things.
It could be, certainly.
But I don't think you're going to get a press release on why.
This reminds me, I forgot to tell you about this. So I was in the airport on Friday when we were flying to Kansas City, and they kept paging to the podium Austin Davis.
Oh, really?
And I was looking around, and I did not see anyone who looked like a quarterback. I pulled up Austin Davis's page to see some photos. I did not see him anywhere.
He's going to be a Seahawk soon. You'll know what Austin Davis looks like.
I could not
soon.
Come up with any compelling reason why I'd be flying to Kansas City. I mean, he played in St. Louis.
I think Kansas City has quite a few quarterbacks.
I guess that's true, too. I wasn't thinking about it that way.
But I was a little bit disappointed when I saw this report about Colin Kaepernick. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily dead. Over time, as time goes by, my assumption is it's a combination of Colin Kaepernick wants too much money. He wants more money than the Seahawks are willing to pay, basically.
I mean, that's the one argument that you could raise against the Seahawks signing Colin Kaepernick.
And as time goes by, if it starts looking like his options are don't play football for this year or sign for less than you'd like to and be the backup in Seattle, maybe it'll start looking a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that this report necessarily means it definitely won't happen. The only thing that would necessarily mean that is if he signed with a different team.
Thanks. That would definitely mean it. I guess if he retired.
But I'm saying the window doesn't shut just because of this. Even if they don't sign him now, the window doesn't shut. There's a long time before the season starts.
Yes.
So I'm a little bit disappointed about it. I like the idea of having a good backup quarterback still.
Yep.
And I like the idea of Colin Kaepernick being that backup quarterback.
It feels like Colin Kaepernick is a classic Moneyball player because he's being undervalued by the market.
Very undervalued. But we don't know. I mean, he's being undervalued by the market. It's just, is he willing to accept less?
Right.
Obviously, by even coming to Seattle and taking that meeting, he had to have some knowledge that he wasn't going to get paid, you know, starter money or get a starting job. So there has to be some sort of level of understanding that, but who knows how far. And it might just be that the Seahawks weren't interested.
Yeah. All right, are we going to talk about the Seth Wickersham article in ESPN the magazine last week?
I still haven't read it. Don't plan on reading it. Feel free to talk all you want about it.
About it.
I'm sure that your comment will be very different than mine.
I'm sure it will, because I was not as broken up about the possibility of Richard Sherman getting traded as you were.
Who do you want to start at corner?
I'm not saying I wanted them to trade him. I'm saying I just didn't get emotional about it.
I don't think I was emotional.
You were definitely emotional.
Okay, fine.
I mean, I don't want to use emotional as a pejorative here. I'm just saying I did not feel as strongly about the issue as you did. I mean, I think it's interesting because the picture it paints of Richard Sherman, and I'm going to go into complete psychoanalyzation from a distant mode here, which is not some ways I usually like to reside.
Okay.
But it seems to me like, I don't know how familiar you are with the book Mindset, which is something that I think has had an influence on Pete Carroll, at least indirectly through the book Grit, written by Angela Duckworth, who has worked with the Seahawks and actually is referenced in this story. Pete Carroll brings her up as part of their conversation. Anyways, it is a book that details the idea of that there are kind of two different mindsets that people can have. Either the fixed mindset, where you think that people have certain innate skills mm-hmm. and display them, or the growth mindset, where you think of skills as things that you develop and learn with practice and repetition, and that they're constantly, they're dynamic and constantly changing.
Which we generally agree is the right mindset.
Yes. It seems to me like Richard Sherman might have a fixed mindset.
Oh, God. That's like the biggest burn that you could possibly have in it's like not, the slightest way.
It's again not a pejorative. I think for most
it's like such a Peltencast burn.
It is very Peltencast burn. He doesn't understand small sample size. I mean, I think most of my life I was really fixed mindset. And probably only after reading this book and learning more about it have I started to move more towards a growth mindset. But, you know, part of it is you kind of constantly feel like people with fixed mindsets are often high achievers because of the fact that they feel this need to prove themselves with what they're doing. That makes sense.
Okay.
And so I think it could help if, you know, Richard Sherman doesn't. And of course, no one really falls into completely a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. You're different from different tasks or, you know, different areas of your life. But it would help explain, you know, the pride that Sherman takes in his growth, in his rise into an elite cornerback is someone who was, you know, constantly doubted and overlooked throughout his career.
So then this is a ridiculous thing to try to understand what Richard Sherman's mindset is based upon some random ESPN article.
So I think it makes sense.
Tell me your evidence for even thinking this. And then also you basically just explained why Richard Sherman should and would have a growth mindset.
Because of the fact that he himself has grown in skills.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, that's a fair point. But
also, trying to understand his mindset off this story is a ridiculous thing to do.
I mean, it's not just off this story. I preface this by saying we were going into ridiculous psychoanalysis from afar. But I think, so when someone fails in the fixed mindset philosophy, this is a really terrible thing. This is a great loss of self. And I think that would explain his reaction to what happened at the end of Super Bowl 49, which was canceled.
About the cancellation.
Yes. And it's, I think, you know, the fixed mindset is also more associated with a need to seek blame and cast blame, as opposed to Pete Carroll, like most exemplifies the growth mindset, where he constantly talks about how important his setbacks are to his career and his ability to move past them.
Yes.
And but I think also, it helps understand.
Pete Carroll is talking about understanding this. He said he learned this after maybe there's like an important Jets game, but also maybe after he worked at USC. We're talking when he was like 60 years old at this point.
I mean, I think he started to understand it younger than that. If you closely read Win Forever, is we'd like to consider ourselves Win Forever scholars here. Not obviously to the level of loyal listener Damon, who wrote an entire book about it, but, you know, still trying to get to that level, trying to grow to that level. But Pete Carroll, I think, you know, was able to move past the end of Super Bowl 49 in a different way than some of his players were because of that mindset. And I think the fact that he is so relentlessly optimistic, it probably starts to annoy you if you're upset about something and you don't feel like it's even being acknowledged as valid.
Okay.
So every strength is a weakness. Pete Carroll's, you know, relentless positivity is in some ways a weakness, as we've explored in the past. And Richard Sherman's maniacal competitiveness and desire to prove himself on the football field can be a weakness. His passion when it crosses over into him yelling at Daryl Bevel on the sidelines during a football game.
So the basic gist of this article is Richard Sherman is still upset about Super Bowl 49.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
Which I think that we probably understood last year during the season.
Yes.
But we didn't understand the depths of how upset he was?
I think so. Although, I mean, the other aspect of this that I will say in defense of the Seahawks players who have been dismissing this article as more or less fake news is that a lot of these things, you know, there's a lot of things that happen, incidents that happen that you can cast in a different light depending on the narrative you're trying to paint.
Yes.
I mean, that's always the challenge of life is to understand, you know, what things really mean. So the encouraging thing about this article is that, you know, it's reported that since coming back for off-season workouts, Sherman has been in a much better place. And, you know, I think the lingering question that, you know, the kind of the article finishes with is, well, what happens when something goes wrong during the season? Does he stay in that good place or go back to the dark place he was at the end of last season? The other thing that comes out of this article is that the defense, it based on the sourcing in this, really believes that the offense is to blame for everything bad that happens to the Seahawks. And let me tell you, I got to disabuse them of some of those notions. As is pointed out in the article, you know, the defense did give up, you know, scoring drives to the Patriots in the fourth quarter of that game.
Two of them,
in which the offense had staked them to a lead. But also, do you guys remember the Atlanta playoff game? We can't, or the original Atlanta playoff game, I guess. No, there's two of them. We can't be the only ones that remember how bad the defense was in the on the final drive of that game, right?
That's before Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril were around, but yes.
True. But still, if you're going to go around talking about how the offense is so bad and such a big problem, like, you better look in the mirror a little bit on that one. When Russell Wilson had a phenomenal second half and led the gave the Seahawks the lead inside the final minute and the defense wasn't able to hold it.
I just don't think that this is a thing that is specific to the Seahawks. I think this is a thing that happens across NFL teams throughout the country. Every single NFL team has some sort of friction between the offense and the defense, and they've decided, because they're bigger names and bigger personalities on the Seahawks defense, to shine a light on them.
I mean, it's weird because it's so hard to me to understand from coming from a primarily basketball standpoint. The idea of, you know, this division on the team is so unthinkable to me. But yeah, I mean, the offense is constantly playing against the defense in practice. You know, there's a certain level of enmity that is built up
and
that way.
Pete's encouraging them to compete very hard against each other also.
Yes, but as it made clear in the article, also pointing out that you've got to lift each other up and not tear each other down.
I guess so. I mean, there's certain ways to, there's things you can say, but then also he is forcing these people to compete against each other. And it's a football team. Like, if this were whomever, like a low-level cornerback, if this was Nico Thorpe talking about it, right? And he had a problem with the offense, nobody would care. Nobody would listen to him.
Yeah, you know what? If Nico Thorpe had a problem with the offense, Nico Thorpe wouldn't be on the roster anymore.
Yes.
Which is interesting because that was Mike Tando was on with Bill Barnwell last week talking about this article and then also his work on Kaepernick. And his argument was that basically the Seahawks don't have enough alternatives to kind of, you know, enforce the same level of competition that they could in the 2013 era. Which I don't know if I quite buy that, because it was not like Sherman was ever in danger of like losing his job to, you know, Jeremy Lane at that point or Byron Maxwell.
No, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but I also understand they've really invested in stars.
Yeah.
They've invested in star players. They've maintained that they're going to keep star players. It's a different model than something like the Patriots have, right? The Patriots have invested in star and that's it.
I mean, they've invested in other stars.
But they've been willing.
But it's also more short term.
They've been willing to let big name players go, and the Seahawks so far have not been willing to do that.
And we'll see if, you know, depending on how things go this season, you know, if they are willing to do it next year with Sherman.
I mean, I guess I agree with you that Nico Thorpe wouldn't be on the team, but also Richard Sherman is a big personality. People like hearing what he has to say, and I think at all times, every single star cornerback, you know, the positions who feel.
Okay, here's an interesting question that I don't think I've seen anyone address.
What is that?
Let's say it really becomes an open Richard Sherman versus Russell Wilson thing in the media.
Okay.
Which, I mean, not that Russell Wilson would ever play into that in
yes,
a million
never.
Years. Who do you think Seahawks fans would side with?
I think Seahawks fans would side with Russell Wilson.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clearly the case.
I mean, we know where this is going if that actually happens. We also know, look, Russell Wilson's going to outlast Richard Sherman on this team.
Yes.
Russell Wilson's going to outlast everybody on this team. Every single player who's currently on the team.
Who will live forever.
But this is Russell Wilson's team for as long as he wants it to be, basically. And eventually Richard Sherman will be gone. Eventually Cam Chancellor will be gone. Eventually every single other player will be gone. And Russell Wilson will still be here.
So will Tom Cable.
But I just don't... I think that if you looked at every single team around the country, if you look at their star quarterback, cornerback, you're going to find a person who at some point or another has complained about the offense.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing I was wondering. If it's basically like there's a different mindset that's required to succeed on defense than offense. Like, offensive players have to be fundamentally optimistic because they're trying to do something, whereas defensive players are trying to stop you from doing something, so they have to be fundamentally more kind of negative.
But also, we know that cornerbacks and wide receivers are the most, like, ego-driven positions, right?
Yeah.
Those two players going against each other, wide receivers, fortunately the Seahawks don't really have any outspoken wide receivers.
Well, I mean, Doug Baldwin is outspoken, but he's not outspoken. Not necessarily outspoken critical.
He's a little bit more team-oriented.
Yes.
But those two positions, if you look on basically any team, you can find players who will blame their counterpart, right? You can find a cornerback on every single good or bad team who's willing to blame the offense for losses, and a wide receiver who's willing to blame the defense for losses. Russell Wilson's not going to get into that business because that's not what Russell Wilson does, but this is just a light being shined onto Richard Sherman.
Yeah,
because it's there, and because he's there, and he's a big name cornerback.
He was clearly on the trade market this offseason.
Sure.
So
I'm still a little bit skeptical about how much he was on the trade market, but
I mean, I don't think the Seahawks would have any incentive to exaggerate the extent to which he was on the trade market.
This is offseason noise. We shouldn't even be talking about the Seahawks. We should be taking a break from the Seahawks.
We should be talking about burgers.
We should be talking about hydroplanes.
Oh, you know, there's going to be a test this Friday in the Tri-Cities.
See?
I'll have some reporting on that next week.
I don't like the constant news cycle where this is clearly... I mean, I know OTAs are starting and the draft happened relatively recently, but this is basically a dead period for the NFL. And it's just, you need to make noise. People need to write stories. And this is a story that was written. Who cares?
We'll see.
We'll see. What are we going to see?
Everything.
I mean, Richard Sherman was the way he was before the story was written and will be after. We're not going to see anything based upon this. He already said publicly what he felt. He said, we saw what happens when he passed from the goal line. That's it. He said it during the season. He didn't say anything new now.
No, that's all true. But we'll see how he continues to respond.
I'm sure that we will, but it'll probably be based upon how the season goes.
I think it very well may be.
So, okay, we'll see how the season goes. Great.
Yeah. We will see.
We've got a lot to do before then. We have a whole summer to get through. We have to watch all of Hard Knocks. We've got a lot of things to get through. We have to get excited about some unknown player. We're not even going to know about them. We don't know who we're going to be excited about in training camp. We have to get excited about them. They're going to make the roster. They'll have a couple plays. They'll get cut. We'll be excited about it.
Oh, man. I look forward to everyone freaking out over. Who's the running back they drafted in the 7th round?
Chris Carson, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
I was going to go with Chris Colvin, but he's from Arizona State. He's totally different.
Yeah. Can't wait to get excited about him.
All right. Sounds good. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.